Welcome to Lady Killers with me, Lucy Worsley, where true crime meets history with a twist. From BBC Radio 4. This time on Lady Killers, we'll see how seismic changes in society filtered through to the justice system. And we'll see how gender and racism affected our lady killers as they were brought before the law. Marguerite Farmy, a glamorous young socialite trapped in an abusive marriage, which came to a sticky end in the Savoy Hotel in London's West End.
I lost my head. I shot him. What have I done? I have been married 6 months and it has been torture.
The Black Widows, a criminal duo from the back streets of Liverpool, who poisoned members of their own family to get life insurance payouts.
I admit that I had knowledge of poison being administered to the persons whose death I am now charged with causing. But I deny that I administered it myself in either one case or the other.
Edith Thompson, hanged for the murder of her husband, a crime we believe she didn't commit. She wanted the exciting life she'd read about in novels, but instead she had a dull suburban marriage.
I do hate this life I lead. I hate the lies, hate everything. If only I could make an absolutely clean, fresh start. And we're going to start a new, clean life together soon, darling, aren't we?
Jane Toppen, a nurse from New England who killed her own patients, cradling them in her arms as they died. Today we'd call her a medical serial killer.
So I let her die slowly, with griping tortures, then watched with delight as she gasped her life out. I kill people because I want to get them out of the way, and poisoning is the easiest way to do it.
I'm joined by a crack team of female detectives to take a look, a feminist look actually, at the wild and unthinkable crimes committed by murderesses in Britain, North America and Australia. We hear their words, their voices, and we ask what drove these ordinary women to do these extraordinary things. What do these lady killers tell us about the world that they lived in and about women's lives in the past? And what might they also tell us about women's lives today? I am joined by Sakisa Bostwick-Barnes, lawyer by day, comedian by night, so the perfect person to untangle some of our legal problems. Welcome, Sakisa.
Hello, how are you?
I'm very good, thank you. Could you tell us a little bit about your day job? Let's begin with your work as an immigration lawyer. That's right, isn't it?
Yeah, I think the title says it all. I'm an immigration lawyer. I've been qualified for quite a few years. My job is mainly to help people remain in the UK and obtain their leave to remain. So we deal with quite a lot of asylum seekers, students, partners. The law itself is quite complicated around immigration. A lot of people have a misconception about immigration in this country, which is why I talk about it when I do my stand-up.
Why did you get involved in that line of work, can I ask? Is it something you feel passionately about?
People think when I say immigration lawyer that I'm rich. I'm not. I work for a legal aid law firm. We normally deal with quite a lot of people who are vulnerable, who are destitute, who don't have money. So trying to get into that field was mainly my way of helping people. And that's something I like to do, is just generally help people and make sure that they are able to help themselves to make a better life.
Now, you also had your debut at the Edinburgh Festival last summer, and you've just recorded live at the Apollo. What on earth was that like?
That was amazing, actually. I had a really great time. I found out I obtained live at Apollo at the Edinburgh Fringe whilst I was doing my debut. I had a quite successful run because the show was all about just living your best life, but also was a reflection about me and my life and what people's stereotypes are of me as a black woman living in this day and age. It talked about immigration at points. It talked about race. It talked about men. I'm very proud of what I achieved during the Fringe.
As ever, I'm sat here with Lady Killer's very own in-house historian, Professor Rosalind Crane from the Open University. Hi, Ros.
Hello, Lucy, and hello, Sakisa.
So, in this series, we began in an Edinburgh, not fringe venue, but in an Edinburgh brothel in the year 1823, where a fight led to its manager, Mary McKinnon, getting hanged for murder. And we ended our series in 1923 when Marguerite Farmy shot her husband in a luxury hotel in the Roaring Twenties. That is a whole century containing the huge hinge of World War One. Ros, can you outline for us the key changes for women between 1823 and 1923?
Yes. Well, visually, just looking at pictures of women, the differences seem huge, don't they? Long hair to short bob cuts, hemlines almost touching the floor to hemlines at mid-calf by the 1920s, showing a bit of leg, and dresses which were much less structured and easier to wear. So the Victorian age, which sits between 1823 here and 1923 there, has traditionally been regarded as a regressive period, a bad time for women, which ended in the First World War, considered to be a great disruptor, which then ushered in a new age, new freedoms, new rights for women, the Roaring Twenties. As always, of course, on Ladykillers, it's much more complicated than that. Women both lost and won rights over the course of the 19th century. On one hand, there was legislation which specifically criminalised abortion and restricted the ability of single mothers to hold the fathers of their illegitimate children to account. On the other hand, we see the gradual achievement of limited custody rights for mothers, limited property rights in marriage for women. In England and Wales, the right to divorce or to separate from particularly abusive, nasty husbands. And also the launch of a campaign for women's suffrage as well. And this was really gathering momentum towards the end of the 19th century. By the turn of the 20th century, advances in artificial contraception and also expanding opportunities for women in the world of work, in clerical work, as shop girls, in teaching, and all the way up to the professions as well. In many ways, the period 1914 to 18, the war was in fact a great interruption to these long-term patterns of change. The gains that women made in its aftermath, the vote, restricted, of course, to women over 30, in certain conditions, divorce on equal terms, these were the results of the long-term trends rather than the war itself. Crucially, it was still the case that despite some of these new rights, women still laboured under the weight of expectations. To marry and have children, to be passive and virtuous, to submit to their husband's natural authority. And these expectations continued to shape women's lives.
So, Kisa, hearing that, hearing some of the foundations for women's lives being laid, like some women getting the vote, accessibility of divorce, that sort of thing, how would you rate progress between 1923 and today?
Obviously, there is loads of improvements that have happened. We've got the ability to vote. I'm going to talk about the UK in general, because obviously some people in the world don't have that privilege that we have here in terms of being female or identify as a female person. But like, no fault divorce has just come into play. In general, I think there is sort of an improvement, but we still talk about equality between men, women and everyone in between. There is still some issues that we need to address, gender pay gap. But I'm also very happy that I don't have to submit to any man. Yeah.
When Ros was saying in the 1920s, people expected women to fall into stereotypes, get married and have children, I was thinking, the 1920s? That sounds familiar in the 2020s. But you're generally hopeful, are you, Sukisa?
I am generally hopeful. Like, I have no children and I'm in my 30s. And the most common question I get asked is whether I want kids. And I'm kind of like, why do I have to rush?
Now, we're here today talking about women and the law. But what fascinates me about our first two cases, medical serial killer Jane Toppin and insurance fraudsters from Liverpool, the Black Widows, is just how long it took for the law to catch up with them. Jane Toppin in Massachusetts killed 31 people before she was arrested. And our Black Widows, well, they bumped off loads of people, didn't they? Without anyone in their close Liverpudlian community dobbing them in. Ros, what do you think it was that let them get away with it for so long? Do you think it's because they were lady killers who were performing caring roles? We're talking here about a nurse and some widowed landladies.
Well, first of all, of course, it's poisoning, which is bloodless. It doesn't leave a great crime scene to go and explore. And of course, poisoners in the 19th century, in particular, female poisoners, generate a bit of a moral panic. It's kind of the hidden crime that women could be quite good at. And it's a way to overcome, of course, their physical weakness. However, with these two cases, I think it's very much about the context in which the crimes happened. Jane Topham was a nurse. She was looking after sick patients or people that she made sick who became her patients. So it was a crime that was easier to hide in the kind of tangled web of sickness. Death is a potential outcome of sickness, isn't it? So there's that. And she also, by reputation, she was a very caring nurse. She played the part very well. As for the Black Widows, these women lived in a poor community in conditions which generated higher mortality rates, overcrowded dwellings, poor sanitation, which meant disease was common, and also good medical care, which hard to obtain. So death was not unusual there either. Also, they lived in an immigrant community. They were immigrants from Ireland and first-generation Liverpudlians. It was a tight-knit community, and it was a no-go area for the police and the authorities. So not only was death more likely in that community, but the deaths were more unlikely to be investigated.
Interesting.
So, Keisa, what do you make of Jane Topham? She is truly creepy, isn't she?
She is very creepy. The fact that she has like a double personality in terms of her being a caring nurse and then an angel of death at night was just like a very creepy thing for me. Even the fact that she was being turned on when they were getting to near death, I was kind of like, that's a bit weird. That brings shivers down my spine. Taking some tips maybe for my future husband. No.
In the books and films you enjoy, can you enjoy a full-on female baddie, someone who's out and out evil?
What I really enjoy is when, if you've got a female character who's a baddie, whether you understand why they've become like that person, because it's their backstory. That's what I'm mainly interested in. Why did they become that person? Let's go back into their childhood. Why in their childhood has made them that person? And that's what I'm really interested in. What has led to them to this point where they have to be like, well, I want to be killing people. I want to be causing people harm and making them feeling satisfied in doing that. From what I read and watched and stuff like that, a lot of people get a weird adrenaline rush out of it. They get a weird excitement from it. And I'm like, you can get excitement from other things in life, like chicken. Like chicken is very, like, get some chicken. That makes me happy all the time. That gives me excitement. Do that instead. Yeah, it is interesting when you think about why these people do it. What is their backstory?
So, Keisa, what's fascinating about the Black Widows, this crime pair in Liverpool, is how the community helps the ringleader, Catherine Flanagan, to evade the law even after the police are onto her. What do you think about this situation? A community shielding someone?
All for community spirit. This is my situation. I've got a personal point of view, but also I've got a legal point of view. From a personal point of view, I'm all about community spirit. You mentioned there were immigrants. There was quite a lot of immigrants. And you do find when you deal with asylum seekers, they do tend to like go around their own people because they feel trusted around that community. It's about trust. It's about who can I rely on? Who's got my back? She's like, well, these people have got my back. I've helped them. They are going to help me. But obviously the police is someone or organisation, I should say, that people notoriously haven't trusted for years. So else are you going to trust? If you can't trust the authorities, you're going to trust your own people from your own community because they understand you, they get you.
So, Keisa, how would you rate trust in the police in Britain as a whole today? Clearly it wasn't there in Liverpool in the 19th century.
I think when we look at certain cases like Sarah Everard, who was raped and murdered by an off-duty Metropolitan Police officer, but also with David Carrick, who has recently come out in the UK newspapers as pleading guilty for criminal offences, including rape, is quite horrific for us to see in this day and age that police officers who are trained, who are employed to look after and care for the community are the ones that are actually committing these crimes.
This is the police in London for people listening abroad.
Yeah, as well as obviously historically, like a case of Stephen Lawrence. When you talk about me being a black woman in this day and age, the organisations that we're meant to have put trust in the most, the police, don't seem to be the ones that help us.
Stephen Lawrence, of course, being a black British teenager from Southeast London who was murdered in a racially motivated attack while waiting for a bus in 1993. He was 18, and a public inquiry into the Metropolitan Police concluded that the investigation was incompetent and that the force was institutionally racist.
But there are generally some good police officers out there. There are some hard-working police officers out there. But unfortunately, because of the media and the public knowledge of certain things that have occurred, it's led to a lot of us to be like, well, I can't trust the police anymore.
Now, moving on to our 20th century lady killers, Edith Thompson. Though her lover, Freddie Bywater, actually struck the blow in this case. And also Marguerite Farmy, who did, undeniably, I think, kill her husband. We have a real paradox here. Edith Thompson was found guilty, although she wasn't, we think. Whereas Marguerite Farmy blatantly killed her Egyptian husband but got off because people were sorry for her. Is that a fair statement, Ross?
Yes, no,
it's like one gets condemned when she didn't do it and the other one gets off when she did. Now, there's a bit of a theme I'm seeing here about judges not doing their job properly in our cases. In the case of Mary MacKinnon, for example, in 1823, the judge actually directed the jury to give more weight to the testimony of the men present than to the women, and actually excluded the evidence of one crucial female witness. Now, clearly, that is not right, what happened 200 years ago. But imagine we were living in the future, Sakisa, looking back to the courtrooms of today, of 2023. What would we look back on now and say, no, they've got that wrong? What fools they were.
This sounds really bad for me to say, but I feel like at times some women may have used their gender in their favour, I should say, to make themselves seem more vulnerable, make themselves seem more weak in that sense, and when we all know that women are not weak, we run the world secretly.
This is exactly what Marguerite Farmy did in 1923 when she got off shooting her abusive husband.
Yeah.
And she got off partly because he clearly abused her, but partly, we think, because he was Egyptian and people were uncomfortable with him being foreign in white, mainly London. Now, one thing we really haven't been able to avoid in this series is racism. Obviously, in the case of our escapee from enslavement, Margaret Garner, in the shoddy treatment of Marguerite Farmy's victim because he was Egyptian, and also the Black Widows, because they were seen as extra troubling because they were from the Irish community. Ross, could you say a bit more about how Marguerite's husband, Ali Farmy, was seen at the time in the courtroom by the press?
Both Marguerite and Ali were foreigners. They were on holiday in London at the time, of course. But she was French and he was Egyptian. And while he might have been, we must say this, he might have been a cruel husband who subjected her to some terrible treatment, including unwanted anal sex, her defence team really drew upon stereotypes of Middle Eastern men in order to demonise him and to secure a not guilty verdict for her.
Nobody comes out of this looking good, basically, do they? It's a real sad, sad story where you've got gender and race kind of competing against each other in an intersectional way.
It is, but it's also the context of criminal justice at the time, isn't it? And it's when you have such a horrible penalty for a guilty verdict of murder, hanging, where there's a desire to row back a bit, isn't there? Especially when there's evidence that a woman has really suffered within her marriage.
That's something that would be different today, isn't it? The stakes would be lower in terms of letting her off, because today she wouldn't be sent to death for it.
Exactly. Mm. Having said that, the character assassination that was performed on Ali in the courtroom by the defence team was absolutely horrendous. And really showed the kind of overt racism that existed at that time, including within the legal establishment.
Hmm. Does the experience that Ali Fahmy had of racism in London ring any bells for the experiences that your clients have coming to Britain today?
I think a lot of my clients and in general immigrants do face discrimination in this country, particularly in smaller towns where there is an influx of asylum seekers being housed there. I feel like people have a stereotype of what immigrants are, who asylum seekers are. They come over here stealing all our jobs. All of this, I think, is a weird misconception where people don't understand the immigration system, how long the process takes. And I think it's quite harsh for people to not understand someone's story of how they've come here, the journey that they've made, and making a stereotype based on whatever country they've come from.
Now, all eight of our cases generated press coverage. And it's quite interesting to look at the way the press itself changed between 1823 and 1923. Newspapers aren't really newspapers yet in 1823, but Marguerite Fahmy in 1923 sells her story to the papers in a very familiar modern way. Can you fill us in, Ros?
Yes, of course. So there are several major shifts over this 100-year period in the way that criminal justice news is produced and also consumed. In the 1820s, as the case of Mary McKinnon shows, there were several different types of publication available, often consumed by different sections of society too. Newspapers, of course, largely for the middling sorts and the upper classes, but also pamphlets and broadsides, broadsides being cheap sheets sold to vast numbers of working class people on street corners and at the foot of the scaffold on execution day. Over the course of the 19th century, newspapers became much more important in this landscape. Those other types became marginalised or fell away, became the most prominent way in which news about crime and justice was consumed. There were daily papers, weekly papers, local papers, national papers, full range, and verbatim trial reporting became a distinctive feature. In the early 20th century, the 1920s, we see the mass circulation dailies, of course, readerships of millions, okay, and which cut across important gender and class lines. But there are also important technological changes, the advent of photography being the most important and obvious one, also the greater use of headlines and subheadings breaking up the text, and the increasing editorial content. No more do we see those real verbatim accounts of trials, those scripts, but rather packaged snippets which really shaped the way that people thought about the cases in front of them. At the same time, however, it's important to point to important continuities stretching across this period. Sensationalism, especially, how to entertain readers with these accounts of crime and justice, of killing, of course. In the early decades of the 19th century, most obviously seen in broadsides, but then in weekly newspapers, and then finally in the 1920s in those mass circulation dailies.
So, Kisa, I'm nearly 50. You are in your 30s. Mm-hmm. May I ask you, between the generations here, how do you get your news?
Social media.
Do you pick up a newspaper?
I do pick up a newspaper occasionally, but I think nowadays, because everything's so digital, a lot of things do come on, like social media.
Now, in our 1920s cases, Edith Thompson and Marguerite Fahmy, there's a lot of interest in intimate details. Edith Thompson's love letters are made public, for example. Now, I'm interested in this because I feel guilty about it, but I do experience extreme prurience about other people. How do you feel about that, Sigisa?
I think when people put label celebrity out there, people feel like that means that there is an invasion of privacy allowed for their lives. And I feel like we need to remember that they are human beings. They do have their own life. They do have their own emotions and feelings. But at the same time, it is good gossip. If they're going to put it out in the public, then that's not my fault to look at.
I'm quite curious about this, Akisa, because you said, I don't want to be a celebrity. And yet you have got yourself into a position where you're described as the rising star, the breakthrough act of the Edinburgh Fringe, and you've performed at Live at the Apollo. And yet you don't want to be a celebrity?
No.
What's your... Are you not using your life as art here?
No, because...
What boundaries do you keep in place and how are you going to not break them?
I think... what you put out onto social media, I think, is very important. Who I am as a person is very different as who I am on stage. So it's about who is it that you're selling to the audience? What is it who can relate to you? Those kind of things.
You just commodified yourself.
Damn it! Well, I've got my stage name is very different to my full name. So there is different personas to me.
Yeah, and fair dues. So we have considered some of the gigantic changes in women's lives between the 1820s and the 1920s, with a particular look at how the law judged some women differently because of their gender. Now, one of our basic reasons for looking at these women is to try to work out what they can tell us about the lives of other less prominent women in the past. Roz, what do you take away from these 8 stories we've told?
I think it's interesting across the period 1823 to 1923 because we see a series of changes for women, some which were bad and regressive, but quite a few that were positive and opening up women's rights. However, there's a lag in terms of the social expectations and ideas about men and women. I think we see that again today. There is a lag between the law and expectations, social expectations, what we expect men and women to do in society.
Interesting. And we also have wanted to use our historical investigations to give perspective to our women's lives today. Sikisa, as a 30-something woman living in London in 2023, what do you think? What's left still to do? What do you think about all of this?
There's still more to do in the UK in general, I think, if we talk about equal pay. But also I feel like the word gender needs to be re-looked at. And I think that's very important for us to evaluate everything in terms of feminism. What does that mean? What does that look like? Who is included? And to have a bit more equality around our legal system.
Thank you. Interesting. We have seen both heroines and villainesses amongst our murderesses this season. But I think they have all helped us to show that the law is not blind. It changes alongside, or as Roz would say, behind society more broadly. Jane Toppin, our nurse, and the Flanagan sisters, our widowed landladies, were hiding in plain sight. Surely such unthreatening figures, almost little old ladies, couldn't do anything wrong. But after World War I, it seems, with some women getting the vote and working and becoming prominent figures, acting almost like men, it seems society freaks out and gets obsessed, unfairly obsessed, in the case of the tragic Edith Thompson and the tragic, in her own way, but glamorous Marguerite Farmy. They're women who cause debate. I'm sorry about their bad experiences. I'm sorry that they suffered. But I'm also glad that they lived so that they've been able to help us learn about the past and about ourselves today. Thank you for being here, Roz, and thank you, of course, to Sikisa. Lady Killers is presented by me, Lucy Worsley, and produced by Emily Hughes. Our resident historian is Rosalind Crone, and our special guest today is Sikisa Bostwick-Barnes. Sound design is by Chris McLean, and the series producer is Julia Hable. And it's a Story Hunter production for BBC Radio 4.
Oh, sorry, before you go, hello, my name's Greg Jenner. I am the host of You're Dead to Me, the Radio 4 comedy show that takes history seriously and then laughs at it. And I just wanted to say that if you like laughing, if you like learning, if you like history, or if you hated history at school, well, we are the show for you. Yes, every episode I pair up a top historian with a fantastic comedian, and we have a lovely, funny, fascinating chat about a different subject from world history. We do stuff you did at school, and we do stuff you've never even heard of. So if that sounds like fun, you can check out our back catalogue and our new series on BBC Sounds. Just type in You're Dead to Me and hit subscribe. Thank you. Bye.